Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is former Environmental Conservation Commissioner for the state of New York and former president of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, 9% of the nation's children have unhealthy levels of lead in their blood, and the source of the problem is the environment in our own homes. We'll tell you what to do about it. Then a portrait of a backyard in Ohio from author Brian Alexander. We'll look at ways of making paper and clothing from plants other than trees and cotton. In Ear to the Ground, we'll hear about an organization that is keeping our communities healthy for wildlife. And our Earth calendar dances with the grouses in Montana. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. We all want our children to be strong and healthy, but sometimes we don't realize that the biggest source of toxics poisoning our kids is in our homes. The toxic chemical is lead, and it's contained in paint that was sold before 1978. Recently, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Urban Development issued regulations scheduled to take effect in the fall of 1996. These will require home sellers and landlords to give information to buyers and tenants about lead contamination. Dr. Janet Phoenix is the manager of public health programs for the National Safety Council's Lead Information Center.
If you know that there's lead in the property, you need to let the tenant or the purchaser know that at the time of the sale or the lease. It does not require testing, but it does give home purchasers the option of doing their own testing, and the contract would be subject to termination, you know, if they found something that they were not happy with.
In addition to notification and the 10-day opportunity for the buyer or renter to cancel the contract, the regulation also requires the seller to furnish a pamphlet about how to protect your family from the dangers of lead. EPA estimates that more than 1.7 million children in the United States have unsafe blood lead levels, making lead poisoning their number one environmental health hazard. The lead comes from deteriorated paint and the contaminated soil and dust it generates. Lead poisoning can lead to behavioral problems, learning disabilities, permanent brain, nervous system, and kidney damage. Dr. Phoenix talks about what lead levels in the blood mean.
And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have set 10 micrograms per deciliter as a threshold. Anything above that is a matter of some concern, and you would want to follow up with your health care provider, and potentially, if the level, you know, rises significantly above 10, the child may need medical treatment. But most often, what you want to do if the child has a level above 10 is find out where the lead is. And that means testing the home, maybe testing daycare, maybe testing grandma's house.
Unfortunately, lead poisoning has been with us for a long time. Peter Montague, director of the Environmental Research Foundation in Annapolis, Maryland, deplores the slow response to the lead paint threat. He says Australia banned lead paint in 1920, and the U.S. EPA doesn't have much to show for over 25 years of effort.
In preparation for talking to you, I read the EPA's Federal Register notice. It reads just like the Federal Register notices in 1971, 25 years ago. The language is identical. The concern is identical. And unfortunately, the problem is nearly identical. After 25 years of aggressive, or supposedly aggressive, government action on this problem, the problem is still with us. It's just shocking. It's almost unbelievable that our society could do this to its children.
Don Ryan from the Alliance to End Childhood Lead Poisoning says we're making some progress.
The real key is that attention is now focused on making houses lead safe. There's some lead paint in two-thirds of the U.S. housing stock. So lead-free housing is not a reasonable near-term goal. Lead-safe housing is.
Ryan says dust is the biggest problem, and home renovation, which produces dust, is the biggest culprit. Removing old paint, whether you do it yourself or have a contractor do it, requires special attention.
Propane torching off old paint is the worst thing that you can do. The next worst is power sanding, taking a belt sander to old paint. It just creates a storm of dust, and the lead dust is then left behind and can present a hazard for months or years.
Many states now require contractors who remove lead paint to be trained and licensed. The Illinois Department of Public Health says that training in dustless cleaning is a key element of their program for workers in the field. If you need help or have questions, Dr. Phoenix advises calling one of two hotlines set up by the Federal National Lead Information Center.
There is a hotline, a toll-free hotline, 1-800-LEAD-FYI, which people can call for information. There's also a clearinghouse number, which is a live line that operates during the week from 8:30 to 5, and that's 1-800-424-5323. The hotline will give general information about testing, about sources of lead, and about the health effects that result from lead exposure. The clearinghouse number will give you a person you can talk to who can answer questions, specific questions that you may have about doing something about the problem, and there are more specific materials available through that second number.
Again, those numbers are 1-800-LEAD-FYI and 1-800-424-5323. Also, your state health department or Department of Environmental Protection should be able to help as well. I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show. Reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. We all have places which are special to us. They could be places in the middle of a city or somewhere deep in the wilderness. Brian Alexander, author of Green Cathedrals, A Wayward Traveler in the Rainforest, presents a portrait of a very special place deep in the wilds behind his house in Ohio.
I am thinking of my backyard. Not the backyard I see now, the pebble-topped patio of a condominium in the downtown section of San Diego, California, but the backyard of my kidhood, the backyard on the outskirts of a small central Ohio town. Not that there was anything special about my backyard, mind you. It was rather prosaic for Ohio. No lawn ornaments, no manicured grass. Just a yard half filled with dandelions and bordered by dogwood, maple, and chestnut trees. Off to the side of our house, our yard extended into what my father called his conservation district, a moniker worthy of a professional spin doctor, seeing as how it amounted to a quarter acre of unkempt jungle stuffed with scrawny trees, boggy, weedy earth, and lots of rabbits, all bordered by a tiny creek supplied with septic tank runoff. This on a street where everyone else's yard was fertilized, trimmed, and massaged into bourgeois perfection. But where our neighbors no doubt sensed disorder, my friends and I saw the world. From our base in my backyard, we could see countless battlefields where we ruthlessly mowed down thousands of Nazis. The creek was once the Panama Canal, a place where we spent an entire weekend diverting the flow through an array of engineering works, and then tramped most of the resulting mud through my mother's spotless house. The backyard was the tundra, a barometer of Ohio's climate. Somehow, daffodils had wound up on the floor of the conservation district, and every year, as February dragged on, I watched for the new green shafts of the flowers to emerge from the soil, my signal for the spring thaw. But mostly, my backyard in the conservation district was what I knew of nature. I learned the rabbits fed in the early morning. Tadpoles became frogs. Skunks smelled. Crawdads turned the same shade of red as male cardinals when you held them over a pile of burning leaves. No pair of keds could survive more than one spring and summer cycle of mud. Snakes made lousy pets, which was why all the ones I captured wound up in jars of alcohol. I still have one, all these years later. That small place I played in so long ago was the Amazon, the rainforests of Asia, the Great North Woods. In my adult life, I have seen the Amazon, the rainforests of Asia, and the Great North Woods. I have even seen the real Panama Canal. And every time I have seen one of these places, I find myself standing in their midst, listening to exotic animals, seeing exotic plants, smelling exotic smells, all the sights and smells I imagined as a kid in Ohio standing in the conservation district. Those places throw knockout punches, not only because they are spectacular and dramatic, but also for the amazing way they have of allowing me, if I squint just a little, to see my backyard from there.
Brian Alexander is author of Green Cathedrals, A Wayward Traveler in the Rainforest. You're listening to The Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, it takes a lot of trees to make paper, but more environmentally friendly alternatives to tree fiber are available. We'll tell you what they are and how to get them. Then our Ear to the Ground tells us about Keeping Tracks, an organization that monitors wildlife habitat and tries to save it. And we'll look at the dance of the wild grouse in our Earth calendar. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Paper products and textiles are one of the fundamental elements of our economy. Today, nearly all natural fibers are made from trees and cotton, but collecting and processing these fibers takes a heavy toll on the environment. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally takes a look at alternatives to traditional fibers.
From the shirt on your back to your Sunday newspaper, fibers are everywhere in your life. They're the reason we cut down whole forests and the reason we use millions of gallons of pesticides to grow cotton. Brian West is with an effort at Earth Island Institute called Raising Paper. He says there are many good reasons to look elsewhere for our fibers.
We have come to rely on very few fibers. The negative ramifications are fairly clear. In this country, 95% of our old-growth forests are now gone. They've been used and consumed by the timber products industry and the paper industry, and this basically has led to a serious decline in biodiversity and just overall forest ecological health.
There are a broad range of materials that have historically been used for fibers other than trees and cotton. Straw, flax, and sugar stalks, or bagasse, are still used to make fibers for paper and textiles. Some environmentalists believe the use of these materials and others should be expanded. To some, the most promising fiber is hemp. Its supporters say it can be used for over 50,000 different products, including paper, clothing, food, building products, plastic, and a range of medicinal uses. Chris Conrad is author of Hemp, Lifeline to the Future. He says widespread cultivation of hemp could displace a good deal of our need for trees.
You're capable of getting about 5 tons or more of stalk per acre by growing hemp. And so that means there's plenty of raw materials. And the federal government did a study in 1916 in which they stated that on a sustainable basis, that hemp produces about 4 times as much pulp per acre as does forest land. Well, you know, our forestry practices have changed. We've eliminated a lot of our forest, and we're now using tree farming. And so nowadays, that ratio has probably changed to maybe twice as much or 3 times as much per acre, but it still outproduces trees in terms of a sustainable yield, not an annual yield, but a sustainable yield.
Of course, hemp is marijuana, and many people cringe at the prospects of seeing acres and acres of it planted. But Conrad says that industrial hemp bears little resemblance to the kind some people smoke socially. He says you'd literally have to smoke a whole field of it to get high. The Colorado Senate recently approved a measure that would make Colorado the first state to legalize the growing of industrial hemp. A similar bill is pending in the Vermont legislature. Another plant making its way into the fiber scene is kanaf. Like hemp, it's a slender plant growing up to 10 feet high. Tom Rimshaw is president of Vision Paper in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He explains that growing fiber for paper might seem like a new idea, but it's not.
About 100 years ago, our society as a whole took a turn away from carbohydrate-based economy, where most of the raw materials were coming from the farm, and we got into things like petrochemicals and mining and extractive processes like cutting down our national forest systems for the sake of fiber.
Rimshaw says kanaf requires much less input from farmers than virtually any other crop grown for paper. He says there are 240 varieties available, and it has been grown all over the world.
As a row crop, it requires less chemical and energy and inputs than almost anything else a farmer might grow. And that's because we're growing the plant for the fiber, not for the fruit or the flower, like most conventional agricultural crops.
The greatest impediment to widespread use of kanaf is money. Investors, paper mills, and consumers have been unwilling to spend the money needed to bring kanaf into the mainstream. Similar problems face other alternative fibers. Meanwhile, hemp is outlawed and laws against it are aggressively enforced. Although you're not likely to be reading your Sunday newspaper on kanaf anytime soon, products made with alternative fibers are available. Hemp products are found in some of the most fashionable boutiques, and kanaf can be purchased from several distributors. If you'd like more information about alternative fibers, call the Earth Island Institute in San Francisco at area code 415-788-3666. That's 415-788-3666. You can get kanaf paper from Real Goods at 1-800-762-7325. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, keeping track of wildlife. 100 years ago in New England, you would have been unlikely to see many wild creatures. We tend to think that's because they had all been eliminated by greedy hunters. But actually, it's because their habitat had been abolished. 80% of the region's forest cover had been destroyed, and creatures, like the cougar and bear, simply could not make a living. So says Susan Morse, executive director and founder of Keeping Track.
We are a conservation organization with an emphasis on habitat protection through field research, which we encourage citizens to do in their own communities. Conservation education, so we have an educational component working with school children as well as adults, and planning, and we like to emphasize planning, and so for that reason we work closely with town conservation commissions in Vermont and like-minded conservation groups all over New England and parts of the West.
Morse says the heart and center of Keeping Track, based out of Jericho, Vermont, are the volunteers who become involved.
The citizens, your neighbors, you.
She takes an inclusive approach that rallies diverse groups of individuals together around a common concern, the love for wildlife. Morse trains these interested groups, which may include hunters, foresters, hikers, and teachers, how to observe, interpret, and record the evidence of wildlife in their region by taking them out, tracking.
We get out and we just point out different things that you expect to see if you're in bear country or bobcat country or moose country, and you're not just looking at the ground, you're looking at above you at trees, you're looking for evidence of claw marks on trees, you're looking for hair snagged in bushes, you're looking for the contents of certain scat that can be diagnostic for what it is that you might be looking at, that sort of thing. And you just take a walk and see what you find.
And in New England, that may be evidence of black bear, bobcat, fisher, river otter, mink. The information gathered is then collected and placed in a Keeping Track database, the purpose of which, Morse says, is to be used with local and regional land use conservation initiatives. If we are going to protect our wildlife, she says, we are going to have to plan where wildlife habitat is going to be. That is, we have to think about whole regions of resources, how they are interconnected, biologically, ecologically, and so on. Today in her native Vermont, Moore says the wildlife picture has never looked better. The landscape is a reverse of what it was 100 years ago, with 80 to 85% forest cover. But drive 4 hours in any direction in New England, she says, and you will draw a line that includes 70 million people. Without planning from us, she fears the creatures who share our home will cease to exist.
That's entirely within our capabilities to ruin it. We've done it once here in New England. We could do it again in a heartbeat.
Join us again next week when Ear to the Ground goes tracking with Susan Morse. This is Linda Anderson.
You're listening to The Environment Show. You can write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Being spring, it's time to go courting. But if you go courting with Colombian sharp-tailed grouse in the grasslands of western Montana, you better be prepared to dance. Beginning each April, the male birds gather on what's known as a dancing ground, or a lek. They're the size of a small chicken with brownish buff-colored feathers and a white tail that fans out when they're doing their display. Marilyn Wood, a field representative for the Montana Nature Conservancy, says the duration of their dance can last up to 2 hours at a time, and sometimes you can hear them for almost a mile away.
Most of the females kind of stay outside of the dancing ground, and when they're receptive, then they enter the dancing ground from the side, and they'll come strutting in, just quietly walking in. The hens come on, and they're like so nonchalant, and they're kind of like looking over their shoulder, like, okay, big boy, let's see what you can do. And the males on the dancing ground go absolutely berserk. All the calling, the hoot and the hollering, and the stomping the feet just go nuts. And one of the ways to tell that a male is in the area, or a female is in the area, is when the male birds start to get super active. And that's kind of what's happening right now out on the dancing grounds.
According to Wood, the males return to the same site every year, resembling wind-up toys as they beat their feet 18 times per second. The object is to obtain the dominant center ring position, ideal for mating. Typically, the grouse look for dancing grounds that are a little bit higher as well as free of vegetation so they have an open area to display in. Consequently, this can make them an easy target for prey, and that's an important reason to have good habitat, says Wood. Tall bunch grass nearby makes it easier for them to hide at the first sign of danger, but much of the habitat has been destroyed, causing a major decline in their population. Wood offers some insight.
The Colombian sharptail, since it's only native to the Pacific Northwest, and they used to be found all over Washington, Idaho, California, Utah, Colorado, up through Idaho and Montana. And currently, we've estimated the populations occupy less than 10% of their range. They've really gone down in numbers. And in fact, here in Montana, we only have for quite a while there, we believe we only have one dancing ground here in western Montana, and that's been the preserve that the Nature Conservancy bought back way in 1987.
In an effort to keep the males and females active on this traditional dancing ground, the Nature Conservancy of Montana organized a rescue program. Working in conjunction with British Columbia, they successfully transplanted 15 grouse to the native prairie habitat of Montana. Wood says the decline of the Colombian sharp-tailed grouse is a good example of why protecting an animal's habitat needs to be a priority before they get to be endangered.
In an area or a prairie that's very diverse, that is what supplies all the components of what a Colombian sharp-tailed grouse needs to survive. And once you change the diversity of this prairie, you lose some of those components, and therefore you lose some of those species that occupy that.
Hopefully, the Colombian sharptail will dance every spring in Montana. If you're there and hear the whooping and hollering, don't complain. It just means there's something to grouse about. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 328. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.